Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Wednesday morning. It's September 9th. Currently, we've got 49 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Heber City reporting 46 degrees. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Sandra Keynes. Good morning.
Happy Wednesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Wednesday. Look for lots of sunshine. We'll call it mostly sunny skies for us today. High temperatures climbing into the upper 70s in Park City. We'll see those high temperatures climbing into the mid-80s in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Thursday, look for partly sunny to mostly sunny skies expected across the area. Temperatures climb a little warmer. Highs around 80 degrees in Park City. We'll see those highs in the mid-80s in the Heber Valley. As we make your way into the end of the week on your Friday, look for partly cloudy skies. We're going to notice that wind picking up out of the southwest, anywhere between 5 to 15 miles per hour. Temperatures, well, they'll be a little on the warmer side. Temperatures, again, in the upper 70s to near 80 in Park City will be into the low to mid 80s in the Heber Valley. As we move into the weekend, we've got changes. A cold front begins to approach the area on Saturday. That'll give us partly cloudy skies. I do think Friday and Saturday will hold a chance of a couple of isolated storms. The better chance looks to be on Saturday afternoon, but either day could have a passing pop-up shower or storm. Not a washout. No need to cancel or move your outdoor plans at this time. Just be aware there could be a couple of pop-ups. High temperatures in the mid to upper 70s in Park City will be in the mid 80s in the Heber Valley. As we head into Sunday, that cold front moves through, and wow, we're going to see a drop-off in those temperatures. Sunday, we could be talking about highs in Park City only in the low 60s with highs only in the low 70s in the Heber Valley. We'll stay in the 60s for those highs as we head into your Monday of next week in Park City with morning low temperatures in the 30s. We'll be down in the 30s Monday morning for the Heber Valley as well with highs only in the low 70s. We will start to warm it back up, though, as we get towards next Tuesday, as we'll be looking at that mostly sunny sky, temperatures back into the low 70s in Park City and highs around 80 in the Heber Valley. And those morning lows will go from the 30s back up into the 40s. That's the latest on your forecast for the Wasatch back on ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Keynes.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Clubhouse Executive Director Jen O'Brien, along with Clubhouse member Jeff. From the Swanner Nature Preserve and Eco Center, the Director of Exhibits, Hunter Klingensmith, is joined by Rose Tours with the Utah Native Plant Society about the new exhibit opening September 12th. And from the Heber Valley Chamber, it's Executive Director Dallin Kosher. This year marks the 25th anniversary of 9/11 and America's 250th birthday. KPCW's Ulibert Libre reports the Heber Day of Service aims to honor both.
The 12th annual Heber Valley Day of Service invites the Wasatch back to recognize first responders and take part in local service projects at Heber City Main Street Park September 12th. The event starts at 9 a.m. with the national anthem and a flag ceremony. Volunteers will help with service projects from 9:30 a.m. to noon. Travis Wilcox, who serves on the Heber Valley 9/11 National Day of Service Planning Commission, says the event aims to strengthen local bonds.
The thing I think that I remember the most is the unity that came out of it for our country. We came together, and I think that spirit continues today. I think that's what this National Day of Service is all about, is trying to unify us, bring us together, and understand that, you know, we're all human.
He says the volunteer projects reinforce this goal. This year, those involve picking up trash at the Wasatch County Event Center, weaving mats from plastic grocery bags for the homeless, and planting trees in Cove Park.
We wanted to put together a wide variety of projects that people of all abilities could participate in.
Wilcox estimates 500 people will come to help. That's up from roughly 350 people last year. He says this year's event also celebrates the country's 250th anniversary.
The goal behind all of this is to bring this community together on a day of remembrance and really to reach out to each other, build bridges, and be reminded of what we can do when we serve one another.
A board of 10 volunteer commissioners organized the event. For more information and volunteer registration, visit kpcw.org. Ulibert Libre, KPCW News.
Well, in July, the large grant winner of this year's Women's Giving Fund grant was awarded to Summit County Clubhouse. In the studio to tell us more about that and how some of that money is being used, I have the Executive Director, Jen O'Brien. She's joined by one of the Clubhouse members, Jeff C. Good morning to both of you. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So congratulations, Jen. I guess maybe start by telling us, what will that money allow the Clubhouse to do that you couldn't otherwise do?
Sure, I'd love to. That was one of our favorite parts of the summer, absolutely. Just for context, we are one of Summit County Clubhouses, one of 370 clubhouses around the world. We provide purpose, community, and support for adults with mental illness. I will say we give tours on Fridays. So if there's anyone listening, either for themselves, for a family member, for a friend who's curious about the model, I encourage them to reach out. You know, they can walk in, they can get a tour, they can hear from members like Jeff next to me and others who spend time at the clubhouse. So with that context, yeah, this summer, the Women's Giving Fund Award, I just can't say enough about what that Women's Giving Fund means to a smaller nonprofit like ours. The impact is incredible. For the clubhouse, the funds will help us with two things. One is just to keep up with a pace of growth that we could not have ever expected or planned for in our general programming, which is from 9 to 5, we run something called the Work Order Day. It provides work-based structure and community and uses those tools as tools for recovery from mental illness. And so we'll be able to be providing the Work Order Day for more community members thanks to this grant. And then really, more importantly, we're going to be able to direct more funding to our emergency financial assistance and housing programs. That's where we see a real impact in the community. We're both stepping in for people, for homeless prevention, people at risk of homelessness due to their mental illness and addiction, and also for rapid rehousing. We have some pretty innovative solutions for people who find themselves already in trouble, evicted, or maybe have been being discharged from a treatment and recovery center with nowhere to land. And in those cases, we'll step in and be able to provide housing, transitional housing support for people in that position.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the clubhouse focuses on helping folks with mental illness build stability and reconnect with the community. What are some of the biggest barriers that your members are facing right now?
Wow, that's such a good question, because you know, there are some people who walk through our door and the first time they come through that door, they're coming in crisis. Some people will say, unfortunately, it's not a good thing, but unfortunately, you might have to be in a pretty dark place to even seek out support from a clubhouse. And in that case, you know, the cost of living here, Leslie, and we know that the shortage of affordable housing units, and it's a shortage particularly of the more deeply affordable housing units, means that if you have a mental health setback, that can turn into financial crisis very quickly. And so sometimes it's just meeting those basic needs, trying to keep an individual and their household stable during a mental health crisis or a setback. But other times, you know, and this is really something I'm observed, I'm always measuring by how many people we can stabilize in crisis. But really, for people, for the majority of our people, they're not in crisis. And the crisis is really one of like loneliness or estrangement or lack of meaning, lack of purpose, lack of something to help them feel part of this community. It's across the board. I will say one more thing about the Women's Giving Fund grant. I think symbolically, this was a really big moment for the community, because this fund, it's for women and children. We serve adults. We serve men and women equally. And I think what the committee saw was that the men we serve, they're also fathers, their brothers, their grandfathers, their sons, adult sons. And I think this was an acknowledgement that mental health crises in our community, they're not rare, they're common. And second, they don't affect just an individual. It impacts the entire household, and if it's untreated, it can also impact the safety, the security, the cohesiveness of the entire community. So that, to me, the symbolism of having Clubhouse selected for an award that's dedicated for women and children was really big. I circled away from your question, but I wanted to make sure I acknowledged that.
Okay, and I do want to get back to that rapid rehousing, but I want to bring Jeff into the conversation. Jeff, tell us a little bit about your connection to the clubhouse and I guess what it's meant to you.
Well, and housing is a perfect way to get into that, because I was in crisis, homeless, living in my car for most of the last 4 years, and ended up here and walking through those doors in a crisis situation. And immediately, what struck me was community, right? just the isolation of being in your car and homeless, you miss out on so much that's important to being healthy and happy and productive. And Clubhouse is all about that. So just, I had no idea, just that one thing, community alone, being there every day, seeing people, eye contact, body proximity to other human beings, socializing, has maybe done more than anything else just to help heal somewhat of what, you know, the improvements you can make just circumstantially. So that's been fantastic. But housing, you know, that instability, that uncertainty of being in a car. Where are you going to live? How do you build your life out from a car? You know, how are you going to work without a place to live? How are you going to live without without work? Mm-hmm. And so right away it was focus on see if they could provide some of that emergency transitional housing for me. And within 4 or 5 weeks, I'm in a place, a beautiful, wonderful place with a roof over my head, with all those things we take for granted, running water and brew a cup of tea whenever you want, sleeping horizontally, all these amazing things, right, that are amazing when you don't have them. So, but community has really struck me, and being there, the work order day, there's so much to do because the members with staff run the place. And so there's always something to do. There's no small job, cleaning up a stain, unloading the dishes, everything. There's so much to do in a place like that, to run it. So it's not just being productive, which feels good to me and I need it. They need me to run the place. It's so fantastic. So the community, the productivity, housing, those are the big three that jump out to me that have put me on this trajectory toward putting the pieces back together, which 3 months ago, I was in absolute crisis. How could you put it back together? Well, it's just that one day you walk in the door. That's how you begin.
You know, why can somebody struggling with mental illness be particularly vulnerable to losing housing?
Mental illness is, well, anyone who's dealt with depression knows how debilitating the hopelessness, the despair, you just can't imagine there's a way out, right? And if you can't work, you can't support yourself, everything spirals, right? The financial, the hopelessness, the stigma of mental illness, asking for help, despair, and then just the habit of living a unproductive, going down the tubes existence every day. It just spirals in on itself, and you need help, but you can't believe it's possible. But you walk into a place like this, and it's just that first step, and then this is possible. I mean, I can't believe just over three months in since I walked through that door, that I'm sitting here able to share what it's done for me. It's remarkable.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, at what particular point did you realize that you needed help, and how did you even know about the Clubhouse?
I knew it. My brother's very active and civically, and knew Jen, and he let me know about the place, and I reached that crisis point where I've been at it for a long time, but it was the finally running out of money 100% that puts you in that point where something has to change or you're done. Because I was at that desperate place that people reach where, am I done? Which is, I hope people listening right now who hear this, who are in that place right now, know that someone may be asking you to try one more stinking thing and you can't believe, no, I can't try, well, do it. One more time, just do for me. Mm-hmm. Walk in the door, connect with us. Or just write down Clubhouse. Just write something. Start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how did not having the housing affect your mental health? I mean, the chicken and the egg, I guess. Yeah?
Well, right. You're stuck in that, and you just, that your habit, your daily routine is about hopelessness, and just the day as you wake up and you can't wait till that day's over. You're just getting each day over with, and disbelief that you could ever get better. And mental illness is so destructive that it's that spiral. It's that continuing daily habit of being unwell, and that becomes your baseline and your routine. And you don't feel like there's too many pieces to put together to climb out of it. And so you just think, why try? There's too many. And when you think about your problem, you feel the whole big picture, not realizing it's just one, that cliche of one step at a time. It's just so true, because you're thinking about the big picture, and it's too much to handle on your own. Just one other really important thing is when you're suffering like that, and you know there's systems out there made to help you, but you're too compromised to go through the systems. you need help. They're complicated paperwork and phone calls, and you're just exhausted. Mm-hmm. And there's people to help. There's an organization to help. There's staff who will pull you aside and say, let me sit with you while you make that phone call, or support you to get you through what feels impossible.
Well, you sound like you're a happy, you know, excited man. And I'm trying to kind of sort out how have things changed so much so quickly. I mean,
it's that unanticipated magic of community. I think just seeing that there was another way, being productive feels so good. It doesn't matter what I do over there. It needs done, and it feels so good to be productive. And of course, I haven't worked for 1,000 years, so I'm at that point where I'll be beginning some transitional employment. And this is that great, every day you're realizing it's a new habit of the mind and nervous system to be productive. You can, and you have your real problems, your limitations, but within that, you can produce a little higher than you feel like you can. You can do more than you think, but you need to be in the right environment, the right support, and then there's the mysterious part I can't describe. It's just doing something.
I think I just want to jump in and say that a few other things is, I think there's just also a feeling of hope that changes someone inside. And, you know, Jeff he's a great spokesperson for the model, because I always say people come for one of those three reasons, you know, work, community, or direct support like housing. And he's there for all three. He's the first one there, and he's the last one to leave every day. And he's created a community for himself where, you know, he's like everybody's brother. And that feeling after you've been isolated for so long is incredibly powerful, alongside the hope of not only am I housed, but I've got people here to help me figure out what that next step is. You just don't feel quite so panicked or alone. It's hard to believe your eyes. And I always say it frustrates me that, you know, Jeff knew about us. His brother told him about us more than a year ago, year and a half ago. And this stubborn guy waited till he couldn't pay that car registration and was really at the end till he finally walked through the door. And I just wish that we could communicate to more people who might be, might be suffering, and get them to seek out help before it's the crisis.
Yeah, and I guess I'd like you to answer that. I mean, in terms of, what do you say to somebody who feels like homelessness is just simply a matter of not trying hard enough?
Boy, that's so difficult.
There's just so much stigma around it. There's such a high correlation between mental illness and homelessness. And what I would say is, give me a phone call, come by, I'm gonna sit you down at lunch with six people around your lunch table who have experienced homelessness. Because about 48% of our members have experienced homelessness. There is, there's so much that happens with mental illness and addiction. Your family is exhausted by you. Your friends become exhausted and fatigued by you. Your world closes in. There are fewer and fewer places to reach out to for help. Your education has been interrupted, which means your job opportunities are less. There are so many lower wage jobs around here that don't pay benefits. So then you lose your access to therapy and meds. But if you have to go back to work to pay rent, but if you do, you lose Medicaid. So again, you have no access to treatment, and the spirals in the system is just set up for failure. The criminal justice system is the number one institution dealing with people with mental illness in our community and in our society. And it's just there's so many reasons, but these are real people. These are people like Jeff, who you're hearing. I've brought so many people on the radio that you've heard over the years that you, and I remember, Leslie, you always say, "Wow, you're so articulate," as if you expected them to be, you know, disabled in some way. They're not, they're real people. These are your neighbors.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about what you had mentioned, the rapid rehousing. Was that something that helped Jeff?
The first way when we started, we had, you know, some generous donors that helped us with an emergency financial assistance program, and we could help someone pay rent in crisis. But what did we do with the people who already were unhoused, right? Or who were, you know, took that brave step to go into recovery and to get treatment, and then were discharged into a place that wasn't safe for them. So we have been taking some pretty creative steps. We've both created arrangements with maybe unused employee housing off season, but also we are leasing apartment units to use for this purpose, for people who could not lease an apartment on their own, so that they have a place to transition, a transitional housing opportunity, while we help them work through the permanent housing wait lists in our area. And so what we call that is, you know, it's just a term that the state uses, rapid rehousing efforts. So we have funding set aside to be able to put someone into housing and keep them there as they're making progress. Most often what we see is that they're able to stabilize, get back to work, they're part of the local workforce, and then they transition out of that unit and we have a bed to fill with someone else.
Ah, okay. And as we know, Summit County's, the housing costs here are just sky high. How do you work with that? I mean, because that means that you're paying their rent.
Sure, absolutely. Well, you know, and we are sometimes for a few weeks, sometimes for a few months. But like I said, most times we are making an investment in someone who has a path back towards financial stability. And that path might be through returning to the workforce, or that path might be getting on disability benefits and being able to support themselves in that way. There's not one path that fits everybody, but we will not take that step or make that investment unless there is a path. We can't afford to pay someone's rent forever. So that's one thing. And then the second thing is, this is a short-term solution. And I'm speaking out as much as I can to say, we need to leverage this Women's Giving Fund and the visibility that we've received through the Women's Giving Fund to build a deeper pool of support so that our clubhouse can do what other clubhouses around the country have done, which is we need to build housing for people with mental illness and addiction. Build that transitional housing so that my operating costs every year aren't sky high with this short-term approach. So if there's anyone interested in helping make that possible, I'm the person to talk to.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your time today. And Jeff, I'm so proud of you. I mean, congratulations. That's just, it's remarkable. It's what a wonderful story you've shared with us.
Well, thank you. And it's great to be able to share it because people need to know about the model and there's a lot of good that can be done through it. It's
Leslie,
amazing.
I have 10 seconds just to shout out to the Song Summit Foundation team for including the clubhouse this year. There's so much synergy between what they're doing and what we do, and they were wonderful to give free passes for the clubhouse members to engage. We went to see Andrew Zimmern and his talk and engaged in many other ways. So we just wanted to thank Ben and his team.
Okay, and a number to call, Jen, if somebody's looking for help.
801-930-0277.
Okay. Jen O'Brien is the executive director of Summit County Clubhouse. Jeff is one of the members. Thanks for your time this morning. The Swanna Preserve and Eco Center will open a new exhibit. And in the studio with details, I have exhibits director Hunter Klingensmith. And along with her is from the Utah Native Plants Board of Directors, Rose Torres. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hunter, tell us about the new exhibit, Ephemeral. I mean, what is it, and I guess what inspired you to bring it to the Swanner?
Yeah, it was really Rose that inspired us to bring it to Swanner. So we were looking for what we were going to do for our fall exhibit, and Rose had reached out about doing a Utah Native Plant art show. And we thought, what a great opportunity to have something in the space for a few months and to celebrate local art and all of the native plants that make Utah so unique and wonderful. And so, the exhibit will be set up. There's over 90 pieces of art in the show, so a ton of things to look at. They're all really unique, and the artist did such a great job looking at rare and unique Utah native plants to highlight.
So what will people see when they walk in? Are they going to see plants or art?
Art.
Okay.
Art and plants. Art, plants featured in art.
Yes. Okay. Artwork of plants.
Yes.
Can you give us an idea of maybe some of those installations, what we could expect?
Well, we actually have a wall of dwarf bear claw poppy artwork. So we've got pottery and paintings featuring the dwarf bear claw poppy, which is one of our endangered species that is endemic or native only to St. George, Utah. We also have other rare and threatened species, as well as a huge variety of other native plants, including a globe mallow wall, which is a charismatic, beautiful orange native flower that artists love to paint, including myself.
Okay. So is some of your art up there?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. So you mentioned extinct. How is native plants, how are they extinct? I mean, they're here.
Endangered.
Endangered. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And how do they become endangered then?
It really depends on the plant. The dwarf bear claw poppy specifically only grows in a specific type of soil, so the gypsum soil down in St. George. And as people drive their OHVs off-road or there's development, it destroys the habitat. In addition, the pollinators who evolved to pollinate that species has faced many threats, so the pollination levels are down and the area that it can grow in is reduced. So there is a couple of places that are preserved for that plant specifically. So hopefully we can keep it from going extinct, but it's becoming more and more rare.
I'm going to say the same thing's happening right here with our yellow rose, our mucker rose, right, that bloom July 4th, and I don't know the Harrison. I think it's the Harrison rose. Mm-hmm. Used to be everywhere, and that's what our 4th of July parade would be the mucker rugby team throwing off these buds. So it's, you know, development certainly mm-hmm. has played its part. Interesting. Yeah. I guess talk a little bit about one, the hours you've got, how long the exhibit's going to be
yeah,
up. And
for sure. So the exhibit will be up from this Saturday, the 12th of September, through November 29th, which is a Sunday. And it is open during Swanner's normal hours. It's free to come and see. There's no fee to come in. So that's Wednesday through Sunday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And we'll do a couple of collaborative events that go along with that as well. So we have our Rooted in Fun Family Day, which is all about plants. And actually, one of the artists is going to come and lead a fun art activity at that day. So that's on, I believe, Sunday, September 21st, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. And then we're working on a few workshops that will also be in collaboration with artists that are featured in the show. We will have some fun stuff going on, and it's a great opportunity to kind of learn about these native plants that are here in Utah. The exhibit is very focused on the art, so there's not a lot of interpretive text, but we'll have opportunities for you to look at plant guides that talk about those plants and ask our staff any questions that you have about them.
Yeah, and in terms of who the exhibit's designed for, I mean, you mentioned you do have a family day, but is it something that children can engage with?
Yeah, they can definitely come and enjoy the art. It is designed, I would say, for an older audience. But our wetland supermarket will still be up during that time, which is really great for littles. And we'll have some other hands-on interactives that kids can do while they're there. So our Why Wetlands table that has a really fun microscope on it will be kind of swapped out for plant-themed things during that time as well, aimed at engaging both kids and adults.
All right. And as we know, native plants, some can have very short life cycles. I mean, is that the basis for the title of this exhibit?
Yeah. Okay. So ephemeral is kind of like, it's transient, it's short-lived. Also, the art exhibit itself does not last very long. So come while it's up and see the artwork and be inspired by our incredible variety of native plants. And One of the main drivers for doing this art show was to connect people with plants. I mean, it's really hard to care about something you don't know about. And so if you are inspired by artwork, you feel more of a connection to the plants themselves than to nature. When you go out for a hike and you're like, oh, I know what that is. And that feeling sometimes is ephemeral, and that connection, and I think we need more of that in our lives.
Yeah, in terms of just, and this is something that just seems like I noticed kind of as the season goes along from June, July to August, are native plants, do they tend to be of the same color during different months? And the reason I ask is it just seems I see a lot of purple in July.
There is a lot of purple in July. And, you know, I don't know everything about why that is. But I do know there are a lot of penstemons that bloom in July, and a lot of them are purple. There's lupins and delphiniums, and those like to bloom in July.
And clematis, yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know that nature per se says everything purple blooms in July.
Okay. People will learn something about the possibility of losing these, or at least, you know, becoming endangered as part of the exhibit as well. Utah Native Plants used to hold native plant sales in the Park City area. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're aware of that, but those have kind of gone away. Is that, are you going to have any plant sales for part of the exhibit at all?
No plant sales as part of the exhibit. We will be highlighting the opportunities that there are to find native plants in Utah, though. The Utah Native Plant Society website has a great resource, link tree to all of the nurseries that sell native plants here in Utah and other plant sales that you can go to. So that will be part of it. And then just last week at the Eco Center, or at the farm facility just on the preserve, was the pickup for the Utah Pollinator Habitat Program. So people from all over the state can apply for that program. You don't have to be an organization. You can apply for it for your home. And they're all native pollinator-friendly plants that you get for free. And you can come pick them up and then plant them in your yard. It's a great time of year to be planting those. They're usually starts for those plants, so they've already been grown a little bit. So that's a great opportunity to look at that. But the exhibit will be more about highlighting the opportunities for you to think about native plants and get engaged with them, and we won't necessarily be having any plant sales.
Okay. Again, it opens this Saturday, September 12th.
Yep, this Saturday, September 12th, and it'll be open all day, but we have a special opening celebration with which I just counted all the artists that said they were coming. It looks like we have about 58 of the artists coming to the opening, so it'll be a great opportunity to get to meet the artists. It's from 5 to 7 p.m. The Eco Center will be open. It's free. It's just an open house, so you can drop in. You can sign up for a reminder on our website if you want, but you don't have to register to come.
Okay, any other thoughts you'd like to tell us?
All of the pieces in the show will be for sale, or most of the pieces. There's a few that are not for sale, but most pieces will be for sale. They won't be able to be picked up until the show is over, but that's a great opportunity if you're looking for fun local art for your house. And then many of the artists also have prints that will be for sale in the gift shop too. So if that's kind of outside of your budget to buy the bigger pieces, you might be able to get a smaller piece to take home with you.
Okay, sounds like a great collaboration. Good idea, Rose. That's Rose Torres from Utah Native Plants. Hunter Klingensmith is the exhibits director with the Swander Preserve and Eco Center. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Leslie.
In the studio now with an update from the Heber Valley Chamber, I have Executive Director Dallin Kosher. Good morning, Dallin.
Good morning.
Let's have a look first at the summer visitor numbers. What kind of summer did the Heber Valley have?
You know, it was on the outside looking in, it looked like a really great summer, and then you dive into the details, and it still was a good summer, but what we're seeing is a little bit of a softening, and we don't have all of August numbers in yet. They're still coming in through transit room tax and other things of that nature, but what we're seeing is some softening. So overall, the year as a whole, we're up with transit room tax collection is up, but only by 5%. But year over year from last summer, we're about down about 2%. So you're about 2.5-3%. So it kind of gives you like, oh, what's going on with the summer? And so we're seeing a little bit less demand in our hotel rooms and compared to last summer. So it was nothing to be too concerned about yet, but something we're definitely watching out for and trying to keep track of to see what was going on. And as I did a little bit of research to try to understand what are some factors that may be contributing to this, and as you listen to the news this morning, diesel gas is up high, gas prices are high, so that might be affecting our drive market quite a bit to say, do we really want to spend this much money on gas to get up to and from places? Myself, I went to on a little vacation with my trailer, and I think I spent more on gas than I did on the hotel I stayed in, so or the park I stayed at. So it was just funny.
Yeah.
So I understand the sentiment.
So as we look, the TRT, as you mentioned, is up 5% year to date. I mean, is that with the number of hotel rooms softening? So is that reflective then of higher hotel rates? Is that where that's coming from?
Yeah, for the first part of the year, there was you saw probably higher hotel rates, and we had some higher demand, meaning there's more people in these hotels for a few months, and then just as the summer came around, we got a little quieter than previous summers. And then, when I say demand, what we're looking at is the number of hotels available versus the number of hotels that were used. And one of the things that we are watching is as Heber Valley continues to grow in hotel rooms, the overall occupancy rate may stay the same or even dip a little bit because that's a percentage, right? But the actual demand or the number of hotels that were rooms that were used may actually end up going up, even though that the percentage stays stagnant or dips a little bit. So, for example, we have about 1,500 rooms in Heber Valley right now, and that'll probably hit 2,000, 3,000, at least 2,000 once you get to Four Seasons and Waldorf Astoria online out there. So, you know, we will, if we hit 50% occupancy, that actually looks like that is actually be growth in our hotel rate or usage versus just even though the rate didn't change. So we look at that so we can make sure our efforts are paying off and being accountable.
Yeah, and as we look at kind of development and people see 40, 50% occupancy, it's like, wow, that's half of the rooms aren't even being used. Why do we need more?
Right. And it fluctuates, right? The we'll get in summertime, sometimes we'll peak at like a 60, 70% occupancy. And then you'll dip into November, April, where it's really quiet. You're looking at 30% occupancies. And that's weather-wise, that makes sense. But and that's something we're trying to work out as a team here is to say, are there ways we can bring visitors in through those shoulder seasons or to level out the demand in terms of not just the weekends, but how can we bring people in Monday through Thursday that helps kind of soften the weekends?
Yeah. So what are you hearing from business owners? I mean, are they seeing strong customer traffic and spending or concerns about a slowdown or?
You know, the vibe in Heber Valley is still very positive. There hasn't been a lot of sky is falling, but I think when you look at percentages of 2.5-3% up, 2% down, that kind of feels a little bit flat, so not like gangbusters, good or bad. So I think that's part of the vibe that we're feeling is still like, hey, things are still good. We had some really great things with our events this summer, so we're still trying to see positive impacts to the Heber Valley, but you know, it's just not as strong as it has been, in previous years where it's just double-digit growth, so which is fine. Yeah. Small measured growth is better than the other way, right?
Any particular sectors that you noticed, restaurants, retail, recreation,
mostly sales tax, that's going to be all over the board. I think our state parks are doing fine. Given that there are some, the reservoirs are quite low, that has probably been affecting an additional visitation. Talk about gasoline prices causing people to maybe not come as much, low reservoirs, maybe keeping people away from those reservoirs as much as they have been in the past. So just literally not as much water as there used to be to surface area to boat on. In fact, if you go to the Charleston area of Deer Creek, it's all dry.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Looking ahead, the Chamber is finalizing its 2027 to 2034 strategic plan. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so this is a strategic plan that we've been working on since January. We hired a company called Whereabout. We had a strategic plan that we started in 2020, which, given COVID, it's hard to roll the dice on that one, what we're going to come out of that. But we actually had a great plan in 2020, but what we saw was that that 10-year plan got obsolete pretty quickly because the growth changed and just things happened faster than we expected, or things changed. So we re-engage with where about, and we're looking at what can we do as our destination continues to evolve. And what I really love about this year's plan is that it's a plan that helps us get us prepared for the Olympics, but it's well beyond the Olympics. Like, what our focus is, how do we gear up, engage with the Olympics, and prepare for and be beyond the Olympics? What do we do beyond the Olympics? So it's not just this one big special event that we have this impact, but for a long-term sustainable impact. So what I really like about this plan, and it's very inwardly focused, how do we up-level our game with our local businesses, with our outfitters and tourism partners, and I really like that. So it's not just about how do we execute on finding new markets and bringing lots more people here. It's more about how do we upskill ourselves that then brings more people here, or creates the experience that is you tell your friends about and is its own self-marketing to some degree. So I'm really excited about this plan, and really looking forward to things like, you know, we're talking about downtown reinvestment and how do we help with that. We talk about maybe not our role, but how do we support with affordable housing policy making. So how just different things that we know that we can be support on and also have impact on the tourism and economy of our valley.
Okay, so the plan includes the 10 high-level goals, some 34 objectives,
yeah.
And it's ready to be presented to the board for approval?
So it's been approved. We're just, you know, putting the lipstick on it, making it all pretty with all the details and everything. So we're executing on that right now. And part of this was about, we talk about growth. We know that our valley and our organization will continue to grow. And we want to make sure we grow in the right way, meaning who are the people we're going to put in place to do the next work? And so what is that work we're going to do? So we needed to look at the goals and objectives, and now part of that is to say, who are the people we need to put into place? So as our valley grows in tourism, as these new hotel rooms come along, what do we need? Do we need content creators? Do we need more sales reps? Do we need, you know, so on and so forth? And that was really part of this whole thing. So we're not just, you know, sticking our finger in the wind and saying, I think we need somebody else now. It's more strategic and more thought out than that. So I'm really excited about this plan. And we've had a great group of stakeholders that have just engaged with this. And we look forward to presenting this to the public and sharing this with anybody and everybody who would listen.
Yeah. Now you mentioned, I think, one of the challenges that could limit economic growth, and that is, again, that the cost of diesel and gasoline. And,
yeah.
Do you see any others that could challenge that economic growth?
So, you know, one of the things I always think is our limiting factor in Heber Valley is I don't think we're going to have a hard time encouraging people to invest in Heber Valley because, you know, it's a great place. It's a great place to own and operate a business and to live and work and play and all those fun things. It's always the great. Now, who are you going to hire? How are you going to get people to work in these jobs? You know, we get these requests for information from EDC Utah or the state. And, you know, a lot of times if they say, we need more than 10 acres or 5 acres, I'm like, I'm not even going to try it on that because where would we put people? And or we have hundreds of jobs. I'm like, okay, that's great. But we need to look at things that are, so that's always my concern is how are you going to hire people. So it looks like we need to look things, lots of multiple pronged solutions from transit to affordable housing to, you know, I was thinking about this recently. What are some other costs that we could lower to help people pay for their own housing? And so we got to look at all these different solutions, not just building more and faster, but all this. It's a multi-pronged problem and needs multi-pronged solutions.
Yeah. And I think the number 6,000 kind of came out recently in terms of what will be needed for the workforce.
For Deer Valley East Village.
That's just Deer Valley East Village.
So by comparison, you know, I know a lot of those jobs aren't going to be just specifically tourism-related jobs, but in Heber Valley, Wasatch County, we have about 1,600 to 1,800, depending on the season, jobs in the tourism industry and hospitality industry. And so you're thinking, like, that's like tripling just that industry right there on the East Village. So it's going to take a lot. And, you know, they're doing, I think they see it, and they're working on some workforce housing right there on right there by the Dordogne. So I think there's going to be, we need lots of creative solutions and not just dragging our feet, right? And so but I also don't think it just means build, baby, build. That there's a lot of nuances in all these different things. And I think our friends at the Mountainland Housing Authority would also testify that.
Okay. Anything to look forward to coming month or so?
You know, we are, you know, some of the fun things coming up this fall is the Heber Valley Railroad will be doing our first stab at a Heritage Day event in the end of September, end of this month, and looking to do some stuff around the railroad and looking to try to expand that into future years. As we lost Cowboy Poetry years ago, like how can we, that was a really great heritage event for our community. So we're looking to reestablish something, and hats off to those folks who started Cowboy Poetry, because it's hard to start a new event and to create something from scratch. And so we're working on some of those things, but the railroad's doing some of that. We also have our Halloween Fest, which is a great event coming up in Halloween in October. So some great things there as well. So check out GoHeberValley.com for those events, and HeberValleyChamber.com for chamber-related activities and event and information.
Is that new strategic plan posted?
It is not posted yet. We are waiting to get the final PDF, and then we'll get it out there for the world to see.
Okay, great to see you, Dallin. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Organizers are raising safety concerns after Park City's Miners' Day Parade Monday. KPCW's Christine Weller reports that event planners are revisiting the rules for next year.
Park City's Miners' Day Parade drew tens of thousands of people to Main Street. The annual tradition is a nod to the town's mining past and featured 50 floats, from local businesses to nonprofits and first responders. The Park City Rotary Club organizes the parade. Miners' Day Chair Kristen Wright said this year's event saw some successes. There were more float entries than ever before, and the crowd seemed larger than last year. Still, she said organizers had some safety concerns.
I saw parade entrants throwing items. We don't want children darting out in front of cars for errant candy.
Park City instated a no-throwing rule years ago to prevent parade goers from running in front of floats. Wright said all parade entrants are informed of the rule when they sign up and before they start down the route. But this year, some didn't follow directions.
We have very clear rules that state you can't throw anything, you must hand anything that you have hand to hand.
In a statement, Park City officials said there were no reports of injuries. They said police were present throughout the parade, and neither the police department nor Park City's special events team is aware of any complaints or requests for assistance. Still, Wright said organizers want to keep locals and visitors safe. She said the Rotary Club plans to revisit parade rules with the city to limit interruptions and increase public protection. KPCW's Ula Britt Libre contributed to this report. Christine Weller, KPCW News.